Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the recent coup in Madagascar. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Salah Ben Hamou. Salah is a postdoctoral research associate at the Edward P. J. Regen Center for the Middle East at Rice University, Houston, Texas. Baker Institute for Public Policy. Salah, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to your conversation. Brilliant. So let's start off. So in the last, I think it's now 2 weeks now, where we've seen the military take over in Madagascar. Can you just give us a brief overview of the recent coup and what triggered it?
Yeah, so in order to basically understand the coup and what basically unfolded in Madagascar, we have to rewind for a few weeks back to the beginning of the what people are calling the Gen Z protests. So these protests sparked around the end of September, and they were centered around some very basic frustrations initially, chronic power outages and water shortages. But as the government essentially waffled in front of these protests, it quickly grew into something bigger. So although President Andry Rajoelina tried to get ahead of the crisis by firing his energy minister and appointing a new prime minister, this didn't do much to calm things down and quell the protests. Before long, the protesters began demanding his resignations, and as security forces started to crack down quite violently on the protesters, parts of the military, especially the elite CAPSAT unit, which we'll come back to later on in our discussion of Madagascar's previous coups, defected and sided with the protesters. And when the coup unfolded, it initially started to look a little bit more like a mutiny than a coup, because it started with CAPSAT taking control of the rest of the military and then urging soldiers to disobey government orders. Mm-hmm. When things shifted into a coup, it was when Rajoelina had fled the country, still attempting to maintain control over the situation. But once he was gone, CAPSAT was able to move in and secure the presidential palace, and then on October 15th declared that he was removed from power.
Brilliant. You did mention a couple of things. So let's start from there before we come to the intricacies of the coup. There's been a trend. It looks like it's a trend where we've seen it in Mozambique during the elections. Sometimes they say we've seen it. We see what's going on in Tanzania coming nearing the election. We see what's going on in Cameroon with the just concluded elections. We saw it in we've seen it in many of these places. There seems to be a sort of protest, youth protest. You mentioned, say, Gen Z. These are people that are far removed from the post-colonial narratives and are more concerned with the bread and butter issues, jobs. Talk about this trend. Does this Madagascar case, does it fit into that trend that is, you know, taking over in Africa?
Yeah, so there are a few different elements at play here. So, like you mentioned, the younger generation, the ones that are basically on the streets now, they're less concerned about the issues that a lot of the figures during the post-colonial era had when it came to, you know, maintaining sovereignty over like the new post-colonial state. And more so, their issues are related to basic bread and butter concerns. How are they going to pay the bills, whether or not they're going to have electricity or water? On top of that, you have, in many of these countries that you pointed out, such as Cameroon and Tanzania, you have an entrenched old guard that folks associate with some type of almost like an oligarchy that controls access to power and access to resources. Mm. So when this entrenched oligarchy or these entrenched old guard take actions such as barring opposition figures from running in elections or do things that otherwise limit the ability for democratic change, this younger generation is less likely to see the polls as a legitimate source for ousting or not even just ousting, for any type of political reform, and are more likely to take to the streets. And this is when things can often spiral beyond even what the protesters initially have in mind.
Now again, when we look at the military in Africa, another thing we've seen with these old guards, you mentioned the old guards. We saw it again, speaking of Cameroon. We've seen it in several other countries where there seems to be maybe a deliberate underfunding of the military, of the being called military, and empowering. We saw it in Chad as well, where these old guys kind of like empower some military unit that kind of protect the government. So it's CAFSAT within that framework of those kind of presidential guard. I think they call presidential guard or something like that.
So your CAPSAT falls within this category. It's a special forces unit, very similar to in Guinea, the coup that happened in 2021. It was undertaken by special forces units. These figures are less likely to be on the margins of the military and underfunded, and more likely to be closer to the inner circle of the old guard. However, at the same time, this places them in a very politically advantageous role. Usually, when coups occur from the middle ranks or the lower ranks or from segments of the military that have been marginalized, these coups have a lower probability of success. These coups are also less likely to actually invoke any actual political change. When they're coming from these top ranks, they have a higher likelihood of success because these units actually have greater authority and greater capability to actually stage the coup itself. So for some leaders, they'll marginalize the rest of the military, but build up presidential guards or build up different special units. At the same time, there's a trade-off here because as you empower these types of units, they also have the capability to take you out if they decide to defect from your regime.
Very interesting. So is that a case in Madagascar? Because the president, interim president, or Conor Michael, they've tried not to see this as a coup. They've seen it as, this is the people's will, which is... So is it a case where an opportunity presented itself, or would you say CAPSAT has been positioning itself or planning? Is this premeditated, or is it just an opportunity? It just clashed with the youth protest or.
So there had been initial reports that there were figures in CAPSAT that have long criticized Rajoelina, especially with his return to power in 2018. An interesting dynamic that should be pointed out is that CAPSAT initially backed Rajoelina in 2009. During the military coup then, which was also, interestingly enough, initiated or rather sparked by mass uprisings, which Rajoelina himself contributed to and then used as an opportunity to propel himself to power. During that situation, it was CAPSAT that basically handed him the position of head of state. So there has been a long-standing relationship between Rajoelina and CAPSAT, basically like this type of porks, kind of civil-military relations. We tend to think of these spheres as very separate from each other, but they're actually much more porous than people often like to assume. With that being said, I think political opportunity was presented to those forces. So while they may have had those grievances, they may not have felt like they had the opportunity to truthfully move against Rajoelina until something like a mass uprising opened up the door. Usually what's important about mass uprisings in basically the study of coups or any types of broader political instability, the study of political instability, is that these types of events basically signal to those who actually have the capability to remove a leader that legitimacy of that, that the leader's legitimacy has expired. So basically we should think of mass uprisings as signals to the elites as much as they are to anybody else.
Okay, let's talk about the immediate triggers. Let's go back to the protests. What are the What are the things that triggered this? It's the weeks before that happened. What are the immediate, what are those issues?
So an interesting thing is that a lot of the commentaries that we'll see now are going to be focusing on the exact demands of the protesters, which were the water shortages and the power, water shortages and power outages. But if you look back a little bit more, like Rajoelina's regime has been marred with various controversies, especially if we go back to the 2023 election, which was marred, which had a lot of allegations of electoral manipulation. Public rallies were limited. Opposition figures, for lack of a better word, couldn't basically muster a strong enough front against Rajoelina because of the structural obstacles that they faced. So this goes back to the initial point that I was making about when you have in certain countries this old guard, or at least this entrenched elite that bars political change from occurring through the ballot box, this sets off this sets off into motion a variety of events like popular uprisings, like coups, in which individuals see that these avenues are more legitimate or more capable of bringing political change.
I like that you mentioned that, because my current research, I've been looking at the utility of liberal democracy. And when I say liberal democracy, I'm looking at multi-party elections and how in Africa we see a sweeping rise of populism, where we've seen it in the Sahel, where people are tired of, and so legitimately so, with some of these democratically elected leaders and how they are more authoritarian. And then there's this welcoming sense of people warming up to military leaders, like we've seen it in Burkina Faso. But if I look at the case of the Sahel and it being one within the framework of anti-French sentiment, and also looking at Madagascar and see that Madagascar is this former French colony, do you see any connection? Is this part of still that anti-French stuff, or is this kind of like distinct on its own?
So I would say when it comes to the populist angle, it has yet to be determined whether this new regime will move towards that direction. What's interesting about it is that a lot of the new government that this that the military leader has just appointed carries a lot of familiar faces from the old Rajoelina regime. So there's the possibility that this swerves into the direction of kind of a preservationist approach, in which the military basically stages a coup to kind of preserve the existing status quo. But if you compare that to places like Burkina Faso and Mali in Niger and Guinea, these were, like you mentioned, populist coups that seek to upend the existing order. These are more akin to what I would call like revolutionary style coups. Like West Africa saw these during the 70s and the 80s, the Middle East and North Africa saw these in the 50s and 60s. Often we tend to separate coups and think of coups as elite driven outcomes, but many coups throughout history, not just in the Middle East and Africa, but also around the world, have been spearheaded by figures who attempt to basically rewrite the social order, be it through getting rid of colonial or neo-colonial patrons, be it getting rid of an entrenched oligarchy. These are very common events. And often what it comes down to is who their main audience is domestically. So if a situation emerges in Madagascar in which the protesters are able to exert enough political will, we could see this coup move into the direction of a populist style, basically military junta. Or it could be more aligned with what if the old guard is able to exert more political influence over the military, then this could just end up being another preservationist style system where not much really changes between Rajoelina and the new system. It's basically just window dressing and dressing itself up as something quite similar.
Let me relate this coup to how does this coup, particular coup, how does it measure up or differs from the previous coup? Because Madagascans have, history of coups. They had one in 72, 75, 2009, like you mentioned, having to bring Rajoelina into it. How does it differ, or does it follow in the same trend?
So there are a few trends in which this coup, this recent coup in Madagascar falls in within like the broader history of Madagascar. First, you have a very important civilian element here. Historically, most of the coups in Madagascar have had some type of civilian coloring to it, either preceded by mass protests, either instigated by civilians themselves. The first coup in 1972 was effectively a civilian handover of power in which mass protests were threatening to upend the standing president, but so he basically handed power over to the military in an effort to preserve the system. So in that sense, you have this this dichotomy essentially, where some of the coups in Madagascar's history have been, again, the used to preserve the existing status quo, and so it's elite civilians who are using the military for that end. And in other instances, you have basically political outsiders, the masses, showing their discontent with the standing regime, either calling on the military to remove the leader, or basically providing the military an opportunity to remove the leader. Where Madagascar, where this recent coup differs, is, like, for instance, if we look back at 2009 to 2025, in 2009, Rajoelina and his allies were very openly advocating for the military to step in. They were calling on the military to intentionally remove the incumbent president. You didn't really see that here in this instance. We didn't really see any public calls for the military to step in. The military, CAPSAT specifically, just took it upon itself to expedite Rajoelina's removal. This doesn't mean that the coup itself didn't have any public support afterwards, because of reporting and basically just videos on the streets will show you that there was a lot of, like, you know, jubilation and basically that Rajoelina was removed. But there is an interesting question there about how far does it go? What are the implications of it when civilians knowingly and intentionally bring the military into it, and when the military takes it upon itself to basically deliver civilian demands, even though they were never asked to do so?
So what I'm getting from this, and what has been interesting to me in my own research as well, is the military in Africa didn't play so much big role in the fight for independence. Matter of fact, the military were part of the colonial structure in maintaining and sustaining the colonial structure. But the military has become some sort of a savior of democracy in Africa. But from your explanation, you can see that the military itself can be weaponized to maintain the status quo. So are we then saying that the military, so it can also be a victim of the perpetuation of status quo? Is that what we're saying here, that the military itself is a victim, or the military is being instrumentalized for this kind of like perpetuation of this kind of like current trends of authoritarianism and all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so it can go both ways, right? So the military, at the end of the day, can serve as a political tool for both the incumbent status quo and for political outsiders. And a few different events can make it so that one will gain the upper hand over the other. In some instances, especially when you have an entrenched elite, entrenched oligarchy, entrenched autocracy, whatever we want to call them, they'll co-opt especially the senior officer corps to protect their interests. And what that will do essentially is, in the case of mass uprisings, you can have the military willingly open fire on protesters. They can even stand, such as I mentioned in 1972 in Madagascar, they can openly take power when civilians feel that they no longer can control the situation. At the same time, there are different instances in which the opposition can instrumentalize the military as well. And there are a few different events throughout African history in which this has happened. One of the most important events was in the precursor to the 1952 coup in Egypt, which basically sparked revolutionary coups, not just on the continent, but around the world, is essentially where you had the military academy open up to basically the masses. So whenever the military grows in size and different individuals from different class backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, what have you, start to populate the military, especially in cases in which there's not a huge emphasis on professionalism, in which the military holds a bunch of different either ethnicities, political ideologies, classes, these types of social identities rise to the surface and can make the military a tool for social change for the opposition as well.
Now,
what this means in practice is that you'll often have, it's tempting. There are a lot of different commentaries throughout scholarship in the 60s and 70s, which viewed coups as these elite instruments that only the elites were able to use, the military, and the military was stepping in just to preserve elite interests. But historical evidence shows that it can go the other way as well.
Let me. There's another coup that happened, which is quite distinct from the coup in the Sahel, where what we've seen in the coup in the Sahel is that the military leaders trying then to perpetuate, you know, try to manipulate the transition system, where they say, okay, we'll do an election in the next 2 years, and when that comes, is they extend it another 5 years and all of that. But in Gabon, there's a coup that happened in Gabon, I think, sometime last year, 2023. Yeah, and then there was a timetable set, and although we can look at that election and still query that election, but the coup leader sticked to that timetable, and people see it as a standard. When you relate that to kind of like mass popular support for, in the case of the Gabon, do you see that happening in Madagascar with this current military regime?
So I think one thing that Gabon has that Madagascar lacked. So while Rajoelina was increasingly authoritarian and had like this entrenched elite around him, I think that pales in comparison to the case of the Bongo dynasty in Gabon, which it has a monopoly over political power for more than half a century. I think in that instance, popular support for the alternative, or for the nation savior in this instance, would be higher because political life hasn't developed as strongly in Gabon as it already had in Madagascar, because in Gabon it had been so suppressed by the ruling family for so long. So it's hard to say that they would be it's hard to imagine a situation in which they would be supportive of new political figures because they haven't developed as much yet as in Madagascar, where there are already alternatives set up that already have mass backing from different constituencies. Whereas in Gabon, it's going to take time for that to really develop after so long under one consistent authoritarian system. Mm-hmm.
What has been the response so far from I know the African Union? Again, when you look at the African Union, before you answer, I feel like the African Union, again, if you see a lot of inconsistency in its position when it comes to countries that take over. So they've not been very consistent in applying their rules, but we've seen them suspend Madagascar. So how do you see, or what are the responses so far of the African Union, another regional countries? I think SADC as well, and then other external countries.
Across the board, all of the regional organizations like African Union, SADC, all the ones that essentially matter, have condemned the coup and have basically the standard phrasing called for a peaceful transition and what have you. What's going to be important here is what regional organizations have largely failed to do in these recent events is, for all their condemnations, they seem to ignore post-coup developments to a large extent. So when timelines are ignored, when transitions are delayed, there doesn't seem to be much of a strong or robust response on that front. So while there's condemnation now, it's likely that going to be the case that they're going to withdraw attention from the situation, and that's going to basically empower the military on the ground, like the military leaders, to have almost impunity in what they do next. And this is going to be problematic when it comes to actually transitioning away from the system that Rajoelina had built around himself, because what the international community or regional organizations can do in these types of post-coup transitions is really empower and support the demands of the civilians on the ground who basically kickstarted this entire thing. And there's statistical research on this as well that shows that when domestic and international pressures coalesce in the aftermath of a coup, this is more likely to either prompt the coup leaders to hand power over to civilians, or if the coup leaders refuse to hand power over, more likely to end in them leaving power altogether. So there needs to be some type of greater engagement from the regional organizations with the protesters on the ground, really backing the protesters and their demands to not let the transition essentially become co-opted by the military leaders and either lead into a new form of authoritarianism or a continuation of the previous system.
I like that you mentioned that, because one of the things I've always said is, and rarely so, populist uprisings rarely lead to the desired change. What usually then happens is you see a new form of authoritarianism or another person just taking over, and then it's the same old cycle. So, but you started speaking to that, how the international community can help. What are the platform? And I like how you compared Gabon, because of Gabon to the case in Madagascar. And I think what I'm hearing, which aligns with my view, is an educated citizenry that is better able to organize, not just protest, not just come to the streets and just but have a structure to. So can you speak more to it in what ways, especially in Africa, how they can affect change without that demand or that uprising or that being hijacked by other negative forces as well?
So one thing that sticks out from like discussions like these about transitional systems and how like an education citizenry is important, it relates to the issue of transitional timelines. So if we compare the transitional timeline of Gabon to the basically transitional timeline that the Madagascar case has been proposed, about, I think, 18 to 24 months, these are wildly different political contexts that are going to require different timelines. In a case like Gabon, where you need more time to basically structurally assist the citizenry to develop their own political consciousness, or rather like the material forms of organization and all these things, I would say a longer timeline is necessary there because the preceding system was so entrenched and authoritarian, there was no alternative for these things to develop. In Madagascar, if we're being very frank, you don't need an 18 to 24 month transitional period because there already are opposition parties operating. There already is a politically educated citizenry that's operating on the ground. So on that front, one of the things the international community can do is become much stricter on the issue of transitional timelines based on the situation. Another good example is a place like Sudan, after the fall of Omar al-Bashir, you needed time to basically recultivate the political citizenry, even though it had a long history of civic engagement and political parties that had been suppressed over 30 years of rule by the Bashir regime. But that situation, again, is one of these entrenched autocracies, and that's very different than what we saw in Rajoelina's case, where it was an increasingly authoritarian leader, a democratic backsliding type of situation, but there was already the structural necessities for organization and for political opposition to emerge. So I think one of the important things that's going to come out of this is that transitional timelines need to be applied based off of the needs on the ground and not to the whims of military leaders.
I agree with you 100%. But then again, if you're looking at international community, we talk about international community and the people to enforce these rules. But then again, we look at the receding democracy, even in developed democracies that we see in America. We see the hypocrisy with what's going on in Israel and all of that. So when we look at that, does that complicate? Does that, first of all, does it embolden these authoritarian regimes in Africa? And does that complicate, give them that lack of moral authority to be able to enforce or entrench all of that stuff?
No, and I think that's a really big component of it. When places that have ostensibly claimed to be basically the guardians of democracy for so many years start displaying incredibly anti-democratic behavior, such as in the United States, with basically the autocratization of the Trump administration, or the situation in Israel as well, what that sends is a signal that you can essentially get away with it at this point because nobody's really paying attention and nobody's really giving it a lot of merit. So one of the things that are really important about any dynamics that happen on the ground is that these things aren't confined to just the domestic borders. They send signals to people who are watching abroad, be it other would-be autocrats, either currently in power, such as figures like Rajoelina or other backsliding leaders, or would-be coupists who have the idea to seize power. This is why even things that coupists have done in Sahel or in other parts of Africa are important too, because they send signals about what can be done if you do successfully take power. So for the international community, when things like this are happening, it weakens their ability to enforce any type of adherence to democratic norms when their greatest, basically poster children of democracy are running foul as well. So I think it's really important to keep in mind the way that democracy is developing all around the world, or in other words, undeveloping, because that's sending an important signal elsewhere.
Mm. One thing we didn't talk about is the dynamic, or the when we talk about Rajoelina and look at how he was deposed. So interestingly, he's fled the country, right? And then he was then impeached by the National Assembly. So would we say, what does the Constitution say? What is the constitutional implication of that? If we're saying, he's vacated his duty, or then he was impeached. So we can say, but what does the Constitution say when that happens?
So in terms of the Constitution of Madagascar, the Assembly was perfectly within their rights in order to initiate those impeachment proceedings. Rajoelina's response to basically dismiss the Assembly was unconstitutional. What's also important here, and this relates again to that issue I was raising with the transitional timelines earlier, is that there is also a constitutional process for what happens when a leader is removed, either be it through impeachment or other means. The president of the National Assembly should be the one who then inherits the presidency until elections are held. So this complicates what we saw in Madagascar, where the military leaders, although claiming to uphold the people's will, also violated the constitution by basically taking the presidency for themselves. So in reality, if the coup had occurred, removed Rajoelina, and then they handed power back to the presidency, to the president of the National Assembly, things would have been fine constitutionally to some degree, because they had followed the constitutional process, which used to be a trend in African coups around like the early 2000s. We often would see that while the military intervened, they would hand power over to civilians or to the constitutional successor and then retreat. But in recent years, this hasn't been the case at all. And this again goes into the issue that in a place like Madagascar, you have a functioning constitution, you have a functioning political system. The need to basically upend all of this and try to establish a new system is unnecessary unless there are some other intentions ahead.
So we've seen, now we could talk about the coup itself and look at the people. So I've heard, or maybe I must have read somewhere where the youth that organized the mass protests are departing from the military, like they're beginning to see, maybe disappointed with the way things are going. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, this is usually a concern that happens anytime you have these widely supported or widely cheered coups, is you initially have basically a coalition of the protesters and the military agreeing on one issue, which is the removal of the leader. But once the dust settles after the coup, disagreements are going to emerge, like very natural disagreements, fundamental disagreements are going to emerge. In the case of Madagascar, it was the appointment of a former advisor of the Rajoelina regime as prime minister, who protesters see as kind of emblematic of the old system that they're trying to change. So for context, one of the key issues for the protesters in Madagascar was the issue of poverty and how the majority of the population is under the poverty line. Yet they just appointed one of the richest men in Madagascar to the post of prime minister, which doesn't align with how they viewed the transition going. Now, while the military leaders have justified this as this appointment due to the individual's experience serving in government and international ties, for protesters, they see this as an attempt to co-opt the transition and basically perpetuate the system that they've been trying to overthrow. And this is emblematic of most coups that happen with popular support. Usually you'll have a situation in which there will be an initial transition. the military leaders appear to be on the side of the protesters, heeding their demands. But once governance sets in, protesters are either marginalized, their demands aren't met, or in the worst cases, repression turns against them. So one key example is Egypt in 2013, after there were popular protests against the Morsi regime, the military stepped in and removed Morsi. The leaders of that protest movement were quickly marginalized. They weren't integrated into the ruling system. And then later on, a few years later, were jailed. So this is a pretty common trajectory after coups that occur amid mass uprisings.
Mm. Let's come to the last question and look at it. What do you, your opinion, how do you see all of this panning out? What's going to be the democratic future of Madagascar? If you look at, you know, all of these trends that we talk about, what can you predict? And then what implications does it have for the continent as a whole?
So I think short of consistent pressure by the protesters on the military leaders, short of the international community or even regional organizations like the AU and SADC really backing the protesters, I see this falling into the general trend that we've seen coups on the continent play out so far, which is more so aligned with the military, like bucking the transitional timeline, extending it indefinitely, running in the election, and then securing it for themselves. I don't see this panning out in a particularly positive light unless there is those necessary conditions of domestic and international pressures coinciding to really make sure that the military stays on board to what the original view of the protest movement and the revolution had initially.
Hmm. And what implications does that have for other African countries? What implications does the Madagascar case hold for other African, for the continent as a whole?
So there will be lessons there, and there'll be lessons for, and those lessons will vary depending on which actors we're looking at. So if we're looking at protesters and other people who are seeking to change, ignite political change within their borders, this will signal that the military is not necessarily an actor that's always to be trusted when it does intervene, because as like these cases are showing, that these situations can quickly become co-opted by the very actors that are initially your allies. For leaders who are lacking legitimacy or facing essentially other critiques of democratic backsliding or autocratization, the fall of Rajoelina signals that they aren't necessarily as stable as they might assume to be. And with things like elections coming up, or with things like shortages of water or power outages, things of this nature, any type of deficiencies that would trigger protesters, these types of things will become far more prevalent to their political survival. Mm-hmm. So on that front, they're likely to take measures to either shore themselves up, either by pursuing coup-proofing strategies, mm-hmm. or coming up with different ways in order to essentially limit public mobilization.
Brilliant. Salah, this has been an amazing rich insight. You know, I really, really enjoyed this conversation. And I'm going to call you afterwards to propose something to you and see if that's something that's going to interest you. But listen, we're honored to have you join us today. I really, really enjoyed this. And we'll definitely call you back to come and talk on the case in Sudan. That's another sad situation that is going on. We've had two episodes already for Sudan, but it's a shame that the situation keeps deteriorating. So we'll bring you back. I'll speak to you later. I'll bring you back to talk about the current situation with the rapid force and the Sudanese armed forces. But for now, you know, thank you very much and wish you the best.
Thank you all.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode with Dr. Salah Ben-Hamoun, speaking about the recent coup in Madagascar. As usual, join me to thank our guests and stay tuned for another episode next week.